But in Patricia's defense, she was a smart lady who had established herself and basically had a reason to expect a bit more. I also, at that point, was convinced I could not stay in Rochester, and her legal situation was such that she really couldn't leave Rochester. She had established herself. Anyway, we separated basically in May or June, and a year later I was out of Rochester. It turned out she was an associate at that time. They did not promote her to partner. Interesting. And then she went to work for some judicial court judge, and I haven't actually spoken to her in almost 10 years. So she is subsequently remarried. I don't know whether she has any kids of her own, but at this point.
You did get a couple more publications in there somewhere.
Desperate. Talk about making something out of nothing. Oh, my God. Yeah, basically, I took something that I thought was doable and made something out of it so that I could fulfill requirements for what they considered to be a PhD. I was underwhelmed. I think, parenthetically, when I got back to Boston, I had a chance to work in some first-class laboratories, which we can talk about. The difference between graduate education in Harvard and graduate education in Rochester is absolutely astounding. There is some truth to the fact that where you get your degree does make a difference in graduate education.
Talk a little bit.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't I just came to Boston in 1981, where I was a pathologist. I should actually tell you that's an interesting story. I was very depressed when I left Rochester. Applied to one pathology residency, actually two: Yale and the Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is a Harvard affiliate. And applied as a postdoc under Bobel's laboratory at Rockefeller, and had all but accepted the postdoctoral position. I was going to get out of medicine altogether, and actually went to look at the gorgeous apartments on the Upper East Side. It's just amazing, you know, the lovely places Rockefeller has. But anyway, Catran, chairman of the Department of Pathology at the Brigham, gave me a break and basically took me when no one else was really interested. And that's break number three, basically. Okay, so I came to be a pathologist, having never done any pathology. Thought it was probably good for my science, but boy, was I rudely awakened. Anyway, a year in pathology, and I basically could not handle that anymore. I needed a break, and was fortunate enough to run across a guy by the name of Jordan Pober, who is a junior faculty person at in pathology, who had worked in Jack Strominger's laboratory. And Jordan is brilliant. He's one of the smartest people I've ever met. We can talk about him in terms of some politics. There are people here who... the politics in Boston is interesting. You could write a book on that alone. But Jordan got me into Jack's lab, and that really was very helpful. Jack is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He's two big labs in Boston, one in biochemistry and molecular biology, and the other over in the Dana-Farber. And basically, I spent some time there, formally under the tutelage of Jordan, but basically working in Jack's lab doing molecular biology. Strominger. He is well known to lots. He's interested in the major histocompatibility complex and basically the molecular basis of immune responses. And Jordan was interested in vascular endothelial cells, and we just brought the two interests together. And the next set of papers have to do with my experience with both Jordan and in Jack's place for the most part. All right, so I did that for 3 years and had a great time. It was at that point that I experienced the difference between the 7 or 8 years it takes to be a Harvard graduate, PhD graduate, and the 2 years it takes to be a Rochester graduate, and the quality of the publications, the list of publications one needs for graduation. Basically, I had a long postdoc to make up for the graduate experience that I didn't have. Mm-hmm. Okay, 3 years of what I would consider to be sort of molecular biology. There's a transition in the CV. I went basically from cytokines and MHC antigens on vascular cells to cloning growth factors. And basically the I didn't want to step on either Jack's toes or Jordan's toes, and made a transition into an area that I thought would be fundable, and it's proven to be so, and that's this vascular express, so-called platelet-derived growth factor. This is a mitogen that controls the behavior of smooth muscle cells, and the argument is very simple. If you take a blood vessel, the blood vessel is lined by endothelial cells. These are basically the gateway to the tissues, and these cells interact with both circulating blood elements as well as surrounding smooth muscle cells. If you injure those cells, they produce substances which are chemotactic for circulating blood leukocytes as well as smooth muscle cells. Such an injury, like hypertension or smoking, may damage the endothelial cell, cause it to release these growth factors and stimulate the proliferation of smooth muscle cells to form what you know as the atherosclerotic plaque. Right? At that time, heart, lung, and blood had very few molecular biologists. So I would consider, you know, my break number four was getting involved in the right place at the right time. I've had great luck with NIH funding. I have two R01s and part of a program project, which all have to do with this business of sort of molecular biology of the vasculature. I've not had, if you count the pew, I think I'm 6 for 6 or something in terms of grants. It's really been quite, I mean, I've been very fortunate. Anyway, my third year as a postdoc, I wrote the first of these R01s, and while that was off at study section and council, I went back to residency. And my goal in life is to run a pathology department. I want to be a chairman. I'll state that straight away, since most of my colleagues know it. To do that, you have to be certified by the American Board of Pathology. The second year of anatomic path was designed to accomplish the credentials one needs to be board certified. Anyway, so I did that. And promptly thereafter, I was fortunate, got a good priority score. I could immediately jump into a funded lab situation. All I had to do was find space, which is not trivial. Unfortunately, in Boston, there are lots of people with money. Space is the limiting commodity. And I had to elbow some people out of the way, some technicians who thought they were ruling the roost, and told the chair that, look, we have an R01, for heaven's sake, I'd like a little space to work on it. And he said, okay, fine. So I've got 400 square feet or thereabouts. Where I am still now, I don't have a lot of space. In fact, my dollars per square foot are staggering, I think. It's just amazing. Anyway, so I fulfilled pathology criteria, eventually passed the anatomic pathology boards, so I'm a card-carrying pathologist. And then basically have been doing research on these vascular things. All right, where else?
Can we go back and compare the graduate school's style of research? Is it in the differences? What really are they when you spell them all out?
I'll give you a feeling, all right? Basically, the folks in Boston have larger space. They have generally more people, usually fewer technicians, more graduate students and postdocs. If you go to Rochester on a weekend, you'll never find anyone in the laboratory. If you go there at night, you'll never find anyone there at night. I hope you're not from Rochester.
No. I just can't imagine a lab with nobody at night.
Well, it's the philosophy of the town. It's a very stable, home-oriented, traditional kind of family life. It's a job. It is not an obsession, and that's the difference. You know, I'm obsessed. I'm there before 6, and I'm there till 8 every night. Okay, I go through spouses like other people go through cars, you know. It is a level of intensity that is different. You have it in the Boston labs. People from all over the world have left their lives and have come to work. They work all hours of the day and night. A laboratory that works 24 hours a day is generally doing interesting things. You have shifts. You have good ideas, and you have people pursuing those ideas, and that's what was missing in Rochester. And that was very clear to me after having been at Woods Hole. Woods Hole, there's an intellectual fervor that's present that is not present in Rochester. At the time I was there, in the areas that I was exposed to, I have to be qualified, I'm saying. and Harvard, MIT, either side of the river. It's there. It's there all the time. You go, you know, my lab, basically, I'm in there before 6, and I'm there till 8. I have plenty of people that work till 2 in the morning, so there's a downtime of only a few hours when someone's not around. Things are going, I think, on a seven-day calendar week. Maybe that's enough of that tirade. Intensity, I would say, to put in a single word.
Now, you can go back to mentors. How does, is Jerry Wiseman in here or not in this piece of the story?
Yeah. No, at this point, I think I have basically have, I'm entrenched in Boston. I really didn't have any contact, much contact with Jerry. In fact, he only visited Rochester once to give a seminar, and that told me something. No, Jerry was someone who came in at a time when I basically was impressionable, and he had a sense of how science should be done, how intellectual life should be pursued, and what he calls the leisure of the theory class, which I find a statement that's particularly good. How one spends one's time when one is an academic, so you have to learn. You can learn how to do science. You can learn how to write manuscripts. But to think about intellectual history is something that you need to live to some extent. And he's good at it. He's very smart. But I didn't have much contact with him at this point. I was developing the tools to be a professional scientist, a professional molecular person in Cambridge. And doing this pathology stuff to a very pragmatic end.
Can you say a little bit more around the politics of that?
All right, let's do some politics since you have people here that I'd love to talk about. Let's talk about the politics in the vascular group in Boston, because there's a guy here who you interviewed last year who's involved in this. Okay. Basically, I came and worked with this guy. Came to Boston, did pathology, and went off into the vascular group. Pathology at the Brigham, if I can be a bit boastful here, is probably the best pathology department in the United States. Ramsey Cattran, the chairman, wrote the textbook which all the medical students used. It's Cattran, somebody. Pathologic Basis of Disease. Very powerful guy. Has a long tradition of vascular biology. He has a... science is a very feudal system in Boston, and Ramsey's the king had princes, knights, squires, you know. Underneath Ramsey is Michael Gimbroni. Michael Gimbroni is a reasonable, one of the first people to culture endothelial cells, and director of the vascular division. Jordan was a junior faculty member in that division, and basically was the first person to treat endothelial cells, these vascular lining cells, with cytokines, specifically gamma interferon. That observation was the stimulus which catalyzed Gimbroni's return to scientific credibility. His Harvard tenure decision was really hanging in the balance. Jordan wrote a series of manuscripts with Michael, on which Michael did basically nothing. I'm going to get myself into trouble since Gimbroni is nominated for the chair of Harvard Pathology. Anyway, Michael was tenured. Jordan basically developed this technology of putting inflammatory mediators onto endothelial cells and causing them to do things. Enter another Pew scholar, Mike Bellalacqua. Michael was the first person to dump IL-1 on the endothelial cells and study leukocyte adhesion. I was basically peripherally involved, so I can kind of watch all of this stuff, which I think would perhaps be useful to you. Michael proceeded to observe that interleukin-1 has effects on endothelial cells, which is important in terms of the endothelial cell's ability to stimulate blood coagulation as well as to bind leukocytes. Why does anybody care? Anybody cares because major drug companies are interested in the anti-inflammatory drugs that could come out of the molecules that mediate these events. Okay, a major battle blew up monoclonals were raised. One of those monoclonals was raised by a woman, Donna Mendrick, who is lost in all of this. Katran, Cimbroni, Bevilacqua, and Polder have all written many manuscripts and received multiple prizes for monoclonal made by Donna Mendrick. Okay? Anyway, this monoclonal basically defined the molecules that mediate leukocyte adhesion and blocked it. That monoclonal was taken to Brian Seed's laboratory. Right? Brian Seed's brilliant, eccentric as hell. I could tell you Brian Seed stories that would absolutely snap your socks, but Brian is one of the world's best molecular biologists right now. He developed an expression cloning strategy. He actually cloned this entity called ELAM, endothelial leukocyte adhesion molecule. At this point, Polder wanted a piece of this action. Cimbroni and Bevilacqua were not going to provide it to him. Jordan was forced to move out of the division into his own separate little area. He is subsequently leaving. Vince Marchese, chair of pathology at Yale, is setting up a Howard Hughes Institute, a so-called molecular medicine institute. And there will be a vascular division in that institute. Jordan is going to chair that as of July. He's basically leaving Boston because of this. Okay, big splash in science. A big article, you know, the molecular mechanism of adhesions are defined, lots of companies wanted in. One company came to Bevilacqua, offering him $10 million, $10 to $20 million to start up a company. Cimbroni blocked the acquisition of those funds. Basically, Michael Bevilacqua and Michael Cimbroni then had a tremendous flare-up. Michael is now struggling to stay alive. He's had one NIH grant turned down and basically has not written another one. He and I collaborated. You may notice there's one manuscript on there. He and I are reasonably good friends. That's why I'm telling you this. Brian did the CD and I did the gene. All right, to look at its structure. I'm very interested in transcriptional regulatory mechanisms. We define the promoter. But because of this interest, I'm trying to give you, and this is going to, I don't know whether I should have said this, but it's very interesting because these molecules have tremendous commercial value, and the politics has determined to some extent what's happened. Anyway, Michael at the moment is definitely leaving the Brigham because of Cimbroni's political power over this issue of the venture capital funds. They're just, you know, they can't seem to stand having one another in the same department. Okay, so Michael, basically Cimbroni, went from Pober to Bevilacqua and is now moving on, trying to play another person, this guy Myron Cebulski, who's another leukocyte adhesion person, into this whole thing. He's trying to show basically that Michael's Bevilacqua's success was due to Cimbroni's architecture and creative thought processes, when in fact that's definitely not true. Cebulski is interested in this stuff called, it's called astral ELAM. It's another leukocyte adhesion molecule that mediates the attachment of circulating monocytes. That's potentially the first step in atherosclerosis. Anyway, Myron is now in my lab cloning all this stuff. And I'm kind of the resident cloner, which is nice, but you know, you get the politics here. Jim, the sad part is, Bevilacqua raised a monoclonal against another antigen, which he called INCAM-110. Okay? That molecule turns out to be the same thing as this astro-ELAM. So Myron and Bevilacqua are at odds with one another because they independently kind of came across the same molecule doing two different things. All right, is that enough politics?
Was some sort of deal made with some other pharmaceutical company?
Michael was blocked from any kind of industrial fund acquisition by, I think it was Cimbroni. But I'm not...
So this was an old-fashioned ethos of science or something?
Well, Cimbroni wanted to set up his own vascular institute. He didn't want to have a junior person, this guy Bevilacqua, running some sort of institute. In the pathology department, there's really only room for one vascular institute, and he wanted to run it. Since that took place, this was all about a year ago, 6 months ago, Cimbroni has gotten us together, and we've tried to market our skills to various companies and to recruit additional funds.
Is it easy to get their attention, the company's attention?
Oh, in this business, sure, because of the possibility of developing these potentially valuable drugs. For example, if one has a heart attack, one of the things that causes damage to the myocardium is reperfusion injury. Polly's Parma formiculocytes transverse the endothelial cell to the damaged tissue and basically engulf it. If one could block that process, one might diminish the infarct size. So there are several strategies that one could potentially employ, and the companies are obviously very enthusiastic about developing these reagents. And in fact, are proceeding independently. There are a number of companies that are well along the way of developing soluble forms of these molecules. The idea is very simple. Basically, what you would do is take a soluble form of a leukocyte adhesion molecule and inject it into your patient that you're delivering something which disrupts a blood clot in a coronary vessel, for example. And that way you would reperfuse the damaged area, but you wouldn't get the tremendous tissue destruction.
Are these biotech companies or traditional pharmaceutical or what?
Biotech. For the most part. When I mean a big company, I would say like Genentech for us would be a big company. We deal or have dealt with Genetics Institute and Biogen for the most part. Now, most of the bigger companies can develop their own stuff in-house. The smaller companies generally have to recruit or, buy vascular expertise. Or at least that's Jim Burney's thought.
Can we just push out on the biotech aspects for a little while? How's that seen changed, and what can you?
Oh, it's a tremendous transition. I would say 10 years ago, people who weren't in the industry are viewed as second class, folks who couldn't do anything in academics. Now you've got great people out in companies, there's a lot of interplay. Many of us have submitted things to our technology transfer office for review for patents. Every time I call something, I call them and ask, is this something the hospital is interested in? And if you have something that's immediately potentially marketable, then obviously they're much more excited. I know I'm on one patent application. I may be on more, I don't know. Since we're so encumbered by Harvard, by the Brigham, we'll never see anything out of these. It's almost another layer of bureaucracy these days we have to go through. But the companies certainly are, because the hospital could transfer rights to some of these things to the companies. And it would save them a lot of developmental time. But no, we do battle with the companies in terms of scientific stuff all the time.
Is all of this affecting the people's research focus in any discernible way?
Not in my area per se. Not in what I'm funded to do, namely endothelial growth factors. I would say what someone like Bevilacqua was funded to do. Sure, they're blowing them out of the water. There's so much interest. They're making steps with resources that he can't hope to compete with. My interests, fortuitously, are not those that a company would be concerned with. It's very interesting, though. We've recently stumbled across the fact that neurons have growth factors, and the immediate interest for them is nerve regeneration. And went to the technology transfer office, and they, of course, were interested for a while and wanted us to demonstrate that, in fact, this growth factor does stimulate neuronal growth or prolong the growth in culture, or, in fact, stimulates proliferation of neurons, something interesting like that. And the companies were certainly interested. But for the most part, what I do... growth factor research, the companies all have their own growth factors by now. 5 years ago, when we were the only ones with growth factor clones, they hadn't gotten there yet. They were still thinking about it. Recombinant growth factors was really beyond them. Growth factors and wound healing was their major interest. I would say the only company-like research I'm doing right now is looking at the role of PDGF, platelet-derived growth factor, in the regeneration of gastric epithelium in ulcers. The idea is very simple. If we can show that if one has or induces in an animal model an ulcer, we add growth factor, and the growth factor stimulates re-epithelialization of that ulcer, then what you would do is you'd give a person this growth factor with an H2 antagonist, H2 receptor antagonist, and you might get tremendous re-epithelialization, and the ulcers would heal quicker. So that's really the only commercial interest. But I try and stay away from things I know companies are doing, because you cannot compete with the kind of resources that they have. They're just, they're very good. Similarly, I don't try to do things that I know big molecular biology groups are doing, because you just cannot compete with 40 postdocs in a well-funded army, basically. They have too much talent, too many resources to really be competitive.
Who are, in your particular area, where are those big
companies? Oh, the sharks? Oh, well, you know, my motto is, if you swim with sharks, don't bleed. The sharks in molecular biology in Boston are pretty easy to find. In our building, the leader is definitely a powerful guard. He's nominated for the presidency of Harvard. David Baltimore over across the river, taking the presidency of Rockefeller. Phil Sharp should have taken the presidency of MIT and did not. I don't know why. Harvey Lodish, one of the guys you know, and certainly would watch out. Stuart Orkin, a Howard Hughes investigator at Children's Hospital. These are people which have large labs, well-funded, members of the National Academy, substantial resources. You really want to stay away from people who are at the peak of their career. Their intellectual skills are high. And you just have to be careful. You don't want to tread on their toes, because they are... It's like swimming with sharks. You don't make any mistakes, because they will chew you up.
How does that happen operationally?
Oh, it's easy. Single phone call. Don't fund this grant, or they get papers to review. Don't publish this paper. I've seen, Strominger is a member of the National Academy. He was called for some one of the people in his laboratory recommendation. He said the guy was terrible. That ended that job. Someone could finish my career in Boston with a couple of phone calls to the right people. These are very major players that you really need to be very careful with. Yes, a certain amount of work is going to always overcome that, but the politics being what it is in the feudal system, there's not much that a squire or a knight can do when the king says, I don't like you, I want you out.
Do you think everyone's very much aware of this? Are all the knights and squires aware of it?
If they want to survive. I mean, I've been there for 10 years. You start as a resident, you end up almost an associate professor. To survive is tough.
What's the other side of the coin? What you have to deliver things as well as avoid them.
Oh, you have to produce. If you don't produce, you're out. You have to maintain political ties. If you don't, you're out. The really gifted people are able to be incredibly productive. And if they can do so in a way that doesn't step on someone's toes, they are do very well. Now, you think about people who have been tenured at Harvard in less than, say, 6 years or less, and there aren't very many. Those are real stars. Doug Melton, who's over in biochemistry and molecular biology, is a world-class developmental biologist. Did something in a department where there is no one like them. He's dominating the field.
I'll turn it over.